Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Ahead on the show today, a bunch of hidden gems. The late singer and songwriter Harry Nilsson seemed to specialize in them. He penned major hits for himself, like Without You and Coconut, and Three Dog Night scored a big hit with his song One. But if you dig deep into Nilsson's solo records, you'll find some great, underappreciated songs like this.
Gotta get up, gotta get out, gotta get home before the morning comes. What if I'm late? Got a big day, gotta get home before the sun comes up. Up and away, got a big day, sorry can't stay. I gotta run, run, yeah. Gotta get home, pick up the phone, gotta let the people know I'm gonna be late.
Later in the show, biographer Alan Shipton tells us the story of Harry Nilsson. And some hidden gems from our own studio as well. We'll hear bonus tracks from recent in-studio performances by Steve Earle and the Brooklyn band Mutual Benefit. But first...
When they put old Daniel in the lion's den,
God put a rainbow in the cloud.
Just to prove and promise to the sons of men,
God put a rainbow in the cloud.
When the Blind Boys of Alabama first started making music together in the late 1930s, Pearl Harbor hadn't yet been attacked, racial segregation was the norm, and 12-inch vinyl albums hadn't yet been invented. But as the decades have passed, the gospel group has managed to adapt along with changing times, often by venturing outside the traditional gospel repertoire. Their latest album is called I'll Find a Way. It was produced by Justin Vernon of the band Bon Iver and includes guest appearances from Sam Amidon, Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, and Shara Warden. The Blind Boys of Alabama joined us in the studio late last year, and we're going to listen now to an expanded version of that session. Here they are performing the song I've Been Searching in the Soundcheck studio.
Searching so long,
searching so long.
I've been searching so long since I found you. My whole life has changed since I found you, Lord. My life ain't the same since I found you. My whole life has changed since I found you, Lord. My life ain't
The Blind Boys of Alabama, the five-time Grammy-winning gospel group, live on Soundcheck with a song called I've Been Searching. Let me welcome the Blind Boys. It's been many years since you guys were last on Soundcheck. It's
great. How many?
I think probably like six, if I'm counting correctly. But for you, Jimmy Carter, that's just 6 years.
Just a drop in the bucket.
That's nothing. Jimmy Carter, Ricky McKinney, Ben Moore, all of you guys were here the last time. Paul Beasley has joined the group since then. And then there's the guys in the band, Joey Williams and Ben Odom on guitars, some backing vocals, Austin Moore behind the drum kit, Peter Levin playing our piano, Blind Boys of Alabama. So, Jimmy, how old were you when you first started this band?
We were singing together in the school in 39.
39.
But we didn't go professional. We didn't leave. The Blind Boys didn't leave school until 1944, June the 10th.
Right. And so, but how old were you all when you first started singing together?
From 12 to 17.
Yeah. All right. And you are, one of the original members of the Blind Boys of Alabama. The lineup has obviously changed over the years.
Yeah. Well, we've had some to pass on.
We had to
replace some, but.
And at what point did it started as just voices, right? It was a harmony group. You were singing gospel, and it was just using the voices.
Yeah, we had a quartet that we idolized.
Who was that?
Called the Golden Gate Quartet.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say them. Yeah.
Yeah. So we were trying to emulate them to a point.
And at some point, that Golden Gate sound is a great sound, but at some point you started adding instruments. When was that?
Well, when we started, the instrument, when the Blind Boys left school, they had nothing but an old flat-top hollow box guitar. That's all. But as time went on, they got amplification, all that stuff.
Right. Now, this new album called I'll Find a Way, this really was about kind of finding a way for all these different people to come in and be a part of the Blind Boys experience. You had all these guest singers and Justin Vernon producing it. How was it working with Justin Vernon up in his cold, cold place there in Wisconsin?
That's what it was. Well, what happened was our general manager came to us one day and asked us, said, how would you all like to do a project with Justin Vernon? So we said, fine, who is he? But after we got to know him, after we were introduced to him, and he's a very fine gentleman, had a studio in his house. We went up there in December. In Wisconsin.
In December. A bunch of Southern guys.
Oh, yeah.
So it was cold, but it was warm in his house, and it was warm in his heart. So it was a good experience.
Well, that's kind of part of the fun of music, right?
It is.
There's always another thing to learn, another person to meet.
Another challenge, too,
Yeah.
Yeah, and everybody brings on their own style, and we take what we got and make it happen.
The Blind Boys of Alabama are performing for us this afternoon here in the Soundcheck studio. Let's hear another song. You want to do There Shall Never Be Any Peace?
That's correct.
All right. It's the Blind Boys of Alabama live on Soundcheck.
Table, yeah. Men are running from land to land, trying to make things all right. Oh, that meeting after meeting, constantly reaching, thinking that everything's gonna be all right. But listen, everybody's kind of playing. Ain't that just like a man? That's why people, can't you understand? We got to change. The dark has come to the light. Who was to blame? Can you tell me his name? You can point your finger like so many other men do. What was done has already been done. It was done by a man. That's why I got to say, we got to tell him.
Preach it, Paul. Paul yeah. Beasley showing off some nice falsetto there. The Blind Boys of Alabama, Jimmy Carter, Ricky McKinney, Ben Moore, Paul Beasley, here live in the Soundcheck studio with Joey Williams and Ben Odom on guitars, Austin Moore on drums, Peter Levin on keyboards. Their new album is called I'll Find a Way. It is out now. Let's hear another song. This one is called I Shall Not Be Moved. Once again, the Blind Boys of Alabama.
I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved.
Like a tree
planted by the water, I shall not
be moved. Do you know
I shall not
be moved?
I shall not be moved.
Do you know
I shall not
be moved?
I shall not be moved.
I'm like a tree
planted by the water. I shall not be moved.
You know
I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved.
I'm like a tree
planted by the water.
Hey,
I shall not.
Would you say,
you know
got the fire in the Holy Ghost, I shall not be moved. I said I got the fire in the Holy Ghost, I shall not be moved. Like a tree that planted by the water, I said I shall not be moved.
Guitar here now.
Come on. Come on, Jim.
Hey.
I shall not be moved.
Said now
I shall not be moved.
Just like a tree
planted by the water.
I'm on my way to heaven. I shall not be moved. On my way to heaven, I shall not be moved. I'm like a tree planted by the water.
I shall not be moved.
I'm like a tree
planted by the water.
Hey, come on, Paul, let me hear from you.
Listen, Jesus is my captain. I shall not be moved.
I hear you, boy.
Jesus is my captain. I shall not be moved. I'm just like that tree planted by the water. That's why.
Blind Boys of Alabama live on Soundcheck with I Shall Not Be Moved. Their new album's called I'll Find a Way. Jimmy Carter, you're not just singing lead there, but basically cueing everybody, you know? I want to hear from you, Paul. Paul sings. I want to hear a guitar solo. Joey plays. In other bands, you know, that would all be done with a nod to a musician. But, you know, as blind singers, you've developed ways of orally cueing each other.
Orally communicating, that's right.
Yeah. The album is called I'll Find a Way, the latest from the Blind Boys of Alabama, the five-time Grammy-winning gospel group. They've been playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today. Guys, it has been a long time since you were last here, for me at least, for you, as you said before, Jimmy, a drop in the bucket, but so glad to have you guys back with us on Soundcheck today.
Well, we're glad to be back, and anytime you want us, just let us know. We'll be tickled to death to come back.
Thanks.
There is something I may not know. There are some places that I can't go.
This in-studio session with the Blind Boys of Alabama first aired in October 2013. Remember, you can listen to our complete archive of in-studio performances anytime. Just head over to soundcheck.org. By the way, we're going to do a little experiment on the website for the next few weeks. and it involves Morrissey. You see, this Thursday marks the 30th anniversary of the release of the debut album by The Smiths, Morrissey's old band. We're going to be talking about it on the show, but as fans of this influential British group know, Morrissey recently published a, how shall I put this, somewhat self-centered autobiography. So we're going to start the Morrissey Book Club. And if you want to read the Morrissey memoir along with our staff and interact with us online while you're reading it for the next few weeks, head over to soundcheck.org for all the details. Smiths and their track Hand in Glove from their debut album released 30 years ago this Thursday. We'll talk about the album on Thursday's show and we'll tell you more about the Morrissey Book Club, in which you and our staff will read the new Morrissey autobiography and breathlessly chat about it online. Get details now at soundcheck.org. Up next, the late songwriter Harry Nilsson was successful writing hits for himself and other musicians, and his cult of devoted fans included the Beatles. Hear the story of Harry Nilsson next on Soundcheck.
She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called the doctor, woke him up and said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, to relieve this bellyache. I said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, get this straight. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and bowled up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and bowled up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and bowled up. Put the lime in the coconut, you called your doctor, woke him up, said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the early 1970s, Harry Nilsson was one of the most famous musicians on the planet. But when he died in 1994 at the age of 52, most people had completely forgotten him, even though they still remembered some of his songs, like this novelty tune called Coconut. The British writer and radio host Alan Shipton has now chronicled this enigmatic story in a new book called Nilsson, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter. Alan Shipton joins us from the studios at BBC Oxford. Alan, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Very nice to be here again.
Last time you were on Soundcheck, you had written a book about Cab Calloway, and it seems like, you know, you've done a lot of writing about jazz. What intrigued you about Harry Nilsson?
I think Nilsson was a bit of a surprise, really. He sort of came up on the inside without me noticing. I was in the States writing a book about Jimmy McHugh, the songwriter, and I guess that's a clue to what intrigued me about Nilsson. Jimmy McHugh wrote for ragtime, he wrote for the jazz era, he was friends with opera singers, and he went right through to the rock and roll era. So it's sort of one-man history of 20th century popular music. And his grandson introduced me to Richard Perry, the record producer. And we had lunch, and I started talking to Richard about his work, and that's a pretty impressive career. But the one figure that came out of that was Harry Nilsson, and Richard had produced two great albums with Harry Nilsson, Schmilsson and Son of Schmilsson, both of which I knew very well. And I said to him, Richard, has anybody ever written a book about Harry? Because I'd love to know more. And he said, nope, there never has been one. And that's really what piqued my interest. And from then, I scurried away and discovered that Harry'd half written an autobiography and then died. that had never been resurrected, never been published, and there was a mound of papers that the family, distraught with his death, had just put away and never looked at.
So you had all of this primary source material just begging to be used.
For a biographer, that's an absolute dream. And strangely enough, it was very much the same thing with McHugh, a man who never threw anything away. Mm. There was a warehouse full of everything from bus tickets to taxi receipts to contracts. And quite extraordinary.
Well, now, with Harry Nilsson, there's a kind of an irony here. He's a singer and a songwriter. But as a singer, his big hits were songs he didn't write. And his big hits as a songwriter were big hits for others. You know, for example, Three Dog Night covering his song One. How did that kind of dichotomy happen?
I think there were two reasons for it. The first thing was that Harry was adamantly opposed to appearing in public. Now, if you're going to be a pop singer, normally you want to do it because you want to get up there on a stage in front of a crowd, but he didn't. And almost everything he did in his professional career until John Lennon was killed, and that slightly changed things because he began to appear on stage to raise money for gun control. Mm-hmm. But until that moment, Harry had managed to live the life of a full-on rock and roller without ever appearing live on stage throughout the main part of his career. And that's an extraordinary achievement. But of course, what it meant was he didn't sing his own songs to a public. And the bands that did, Three Dog Night was doing a stadium tour at the time that Harry was simply resolutely refusing to appear. So, of course, everybody reckoned that the song was theirs.
Right. I know I was surprised to find that it was, in fact, a Harry Nilsson tune. Equally surprising to many would be that Harry Nilsson's Grammy-winning hit song Everybody's Talkin' from the film Midnight Cowboy was, in fact, not his song. I mean, it's so closely associated with him.
Yes, written by Fred Neil. And actually, if you go and hear Fred Neil's version of it, which is from an album which he did just around that time on the Capitol label, it's not very good. I mean, it's quite extraordinary that Nilsson and his producer, Rick Jarrett, heard it and they thought, we can do something with this. And the two biggest hits that Nilsson had were both cases of taking a song that somebody else had done all right with, but not really made work properly. And with a little touch of genius, Harry's extraordinary voice and an absolutely brilliant arrangement by a man called George Tipton, this song, Everybody's Talking, was transformed from an everyday kind of Greenwich Village sing-alongy folk song into a masterpiece.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stop and stare. I can't see their faces, only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast wind, sailing on summer breeze and skipping over the ocean. Like
Harry Nilsson with Everybody's Talkin', originally from his 1968 album Aerial Ballet, but of course it was included in the film Midnight Cowboy and became a smash hit in 1969, won a Grammy for Nilsson, the first of two in his career. The book is called Nilsson, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter by Alan Shipton. He's with us from the studios at BBC Oxford. So sketch for us briefly who this guy was. I mean, he was born to humble beginnings in a rough neighborhood in Brooklyn before moving out west. How did he become just Nilsson, which was the only name he used for a while there in his heyday?
That was a sort of marketing ploy which came in the mid-1960s. As you say, had this very rough childhood, grew up in the 40s in Brooklyn, just at the tail end of World War II. And then his mother, who separated from his dad, who was a bit of an alcoholic and a bit of a spendthrift, she used to bounce checks, and there were always bailiffs and lawyers coming after, and the children had a ghastly time avoiding being taken into care. she kept skipping off somewhere else. So they went to the West Coast. Then she ran up just too many debts and drank just too much and had too many lovers there, and she had to come back to the East. And so Harry's childhood was this sort of skipping between coasts. And eventually, as a teenager, his mother vermouthed from Long Island, went back to California, and Harry, at the age of 15, hitchhiked from coast to coast in the States. And that was a big growing up experience for him. And I think the things that shaped his lyrics as a songwriter was that very, very tough childhood, the loss of his father, who he thought was dead, but actually he'd simply gone off and married somebody else. And when Harry became famous, his dad suddenly reappeared, and that was quite a shock for him. But that shaped the man who he was as a lyricist, a very tough childhood, very ironic sense of humour. He could turn the most tragic consequence into something funny and throwaway. So when, aged seven, his beloved pet cat was frozen stiff in a blizzard, and when the snow melted, they found this thing scratching at the door trying to come back into the house, Harry said, oh,
frozen, God, frozen in that position.
Frozen stiff. He said, oh, he looks like the Roadrunner. I mean, it was throwing off something that really meant a lot to him with a joke, and he would do this right the way through his life.
Is that where Schmilson, Nilsson Schmilson, comes from, that same sense of humour?
That's that, and of course Richard Perry, also a Brooklyn boy, and very much a Jewish Brooklyn boy, with all the shtick and the humour that comes from that. That's a title they cooked up together, and from then on, Nilsson always, as I was going to say, shined his letters, Schmilson, but that's what he did. He always used to sign himself Big Daddy Schmilson, or just Schmiel.
We're talking about Harry Nilsson, the singer-songwriter. 1967, he releases the album Pandemonium Shadow Show. You write about, you know, it was originally supposed to be titled Something Wicked This Way Comes, after the Ray Bradbury novel. But for various reasons, it becomes this other title instead. And on it is a song called 1941, which seems to go, Alan, to exactly what you were just talking about, this odd mix of irony and humor with this really kind of pathos-laden, deeply emotional story.
Well, the lyric begins, well, in 1941, a happy father had a son, and by 1944, the father walked right out the door. In 45, the mum and son were still alive, but who can tell in 46 if the two are to survive? And I think that ran right through his life. I mean, even though he was reconciled with his father, history repeated itself, because in the early 70s, Harry did exactly the same thing to his own son, Zach. It was chillingly, it's like another thing like the mirror. Mm. There are lots of things, lots of portents in his life that then come round and become true later on.
The song is called 1941, early song from Harry Nilsson.
Well, in 1941, a happy father had a son. And by 1944, the father walks right out the door. And in 45, the mom and son were still alive. But who could tell in 46 if the two were to survive? Well, the years were passing quickly, but not fast enough for him. So he closed his eyes till 55, then he opened them up again. And when he looked around, he saw a clown, and the clown seemed very gay. And he said, I'd like to join that circus clown and run away. Yo do 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 ra di di la da dum da da da. Yo do do do.
Just a little bit of 1941 from the early Harry Nilsson record, Pandemonium Shadow Show. Nilsson, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter, is a new book from my guest Alan Shipton, the English author, music critic, and BBC host. And Alan, in the book, you write about the Nilsson sound, this kind of close harmony in the brass especially, which we just heard there in 1941, and that is pretty much the work of a guy named George Tipton. They have a falling out later in Nilsson's career, and Tipton was not in that documentary that they did about Nilsson a couple of years back, and I don't see him, you know, in your list of interviews either. Does he just refuse to talk about his work with Nilsson?
He has spoken to one or two close friends of Nilsson about it, but he absolutely didn't want to be in the documentary. I worked quite closely with John Scheinfeld, who produced that film, Who is Harry Nilsson and Why is Everybody Talking About Him? And I made efforts to try and contact him. It's interesting, almost everybody who knew Harry really, really wanted to talk to me for this book. So people like Van Dyke Parks, Perry Botkin Jr., Eric Idle, a lot of the people who worked with him over the years wanted to tell the Harry story because they loved him dearly. Jimmy Webb is another one. And yet, for some reason, George Tipton, who, as you say, shaped what was called the Nielsen sound, that mournful brass, along with a slight sense of circus, and there's a big circus tradition. Nielsen's grandfather actually ran a circus in California. The Scandinavian branch of the family arrived in the United States, and Harry's grandfather ran something called the Aerial Ballet. And I always thought this was a bit of a myth until I found some court cases from the 1890s which actually prove that Mr. Nielsen was indeed running a sort of ballet mixture of circus and trapeze show, and somebody else had infringed his copyright and he went to court to protect it. So it really is a circus tradition, and Rick Jarrod, the producer, and George Tipton, with both of whom Harry fell out, were the people who created that sound that somehow captured the circusy, nonchalant surface side of the songs with that deep meaning that we saw in 1941 hidden underneath.
The sound of all that brass is also somewhat reminiscent of the Beatles, who were very much, you know, exploring some of those same sounds. And there's the famous press conference story where John Lennon is asked who's his favorite American group and answers Nielsen. And then later Paul McCartney is asked the same question and he too says Nielsen. They all become kind of not just fans, but eventually friends of Harry Nielsen, aren't they?
Friends and collaborators. And the two great friendships in Nielsen's life were John Lennon and Ringo Starr. And in different ways, they both led to a very fruitful partnership. I think with Lennon, the partnership was slightly compromised by the fact that both of them rather enjoyed what is known as the nightlife.
what we euphemistically call the rock and roll lifestyle.
Absolutely. And the album Pussycats, which Lennon produced for Harry, is not his finest work, I have to say, not either of their finest work, although it does have some good moments on it. Interestingly, I think Ringo and Harry produced some great pieces of music, and my favourite of all of them is Ringo's You're 16, You're Beautiful in Your Mind, the old song put back together by Ringo, and all the other voices on that hit single, which went to the top of the charts both sides of the Atlantic, are Harry. He is the falsetto voices, he's the bass voices, he's all the oohs and ahs.
You're my baby.
That's what the Beatles meant by Harry's our favourite group. He had that ability to be a complete choir in himself, and perhaps there's no better example of that than the album he made with Randy Newman, where there are apparently on one track over 101 overdubs.
Important to mention that when he recorded that Randy Newman record, nobody knew who Randy Newman was. It was a big boost to his career when Nielsen took him on.
And equally, nobody knew how to overdub in more than eight tracks. So suddenly to have a 100-track overdub, that is really pushing the technology beyond its limits at the time. So you've got two things. Harry spotting another person who's writing with this slightly off-centre and original, interesting kind of song, exactly the thing that Harry himself liked to do. And at the same time, pushing the technology so that what they create is unlike any album that's ever been made before.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Harry Nielsen with his biographer, Alan Shipton. First biography of the singer-songwriter who was such a huge figure in the 1970s, especially the early 70s. And Alan, you mentioned the friendships with John Lennon and Ringo Starr, especially with The Point. There's this animated ABC TV movie, and this is another collaboration with Ringo Starr, right?
Well, Ringo voiced the eventual DVD issue of it. But in fact, the original voice on the first television film was Dustin Hoffman, whom Harry just persuaded to put the voice over for, well, Dustin Hoffman was earning over $1 million a movie. He did it for 20 grand, which seems to me like nothing. And that's what Harry described it as. He did it for nothing, he said. So, yes, The Point, really interesting idea. This is Harry had... There's a great undercurrent in Harry's life. There he has this alcoholic mother. He fights off alcoholism himself. During the early years when he's really building his career, he's a responsible bank clerk. He spent 8 years working in a bank in the greater Los Angeles area. and he worked in the night shift, so he would then go on and spend the rest of the night writing songs, fall asleep in the small hours of the morning, and spend the daytime hours going around music publishers selling what he'd written during the night. Didn't need a lot of sleep, evidently, as a young man. Now, in that period, when he's really trying to make it, he doesn't drink and he doesn't smoke very much. But then everybody's talking, starts to sell, it's his first million seller, he wins a Grammy, and he starts relaxing a bit. And two things, Harry loved taking drugs and he loved drinking. So he started doing both, making up for lost time. And the point comes from an LSD trip. He used to live on Woodrow Wilson Drive in the Hollywood Hills. He was taking his dog out for a walk and looking at one of the hiking trails, absolutely out of his head on LSD. And all the trees suddenly looked spikier and sharper than he'd ever seen them. Every blade of grass looked spikier and stronger. And suddenly he realised, as he says, everything had a point. And that was the beginning of the inspiration of this morality tale that became one of the most successful children's television films of all time.
So his own Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds story.
Completely, yes. Very different from the sort of in-your-face psychedelia of the Beatles. It's much more subtle with Nilsson. But actually, if you look at the film, it's a trip.
Let's hear Me and My Arrow from The Point from 1971, this animated TV movie for ABC.
Straighter than narrow, wherever we go, everyone knows.
My Arrow from Harry Nilsson and his animated ABC TV movie The Point from 1971, originally narrated, as Alan Shipton was telling us, by Dustin Hoffman. The DVD is narrated by his longtime friend Ringo Starr. You mentioned, Alan, that Harry Nilsson enjoyed drugs and alcohol and, you know, sort of walked out on his first wife and son, remarried, had another family. The decline of his career is paralleled by a precipitous decline in his finances. He was the victim of some major embezzlement, right?
Yes, though, I mean, I think he's also the victim of not keeping his eye on the ball with the company that he'd founded to make films. His later life, you have to imagine that all the way through the 70s, although he was less popular than he had been, he continued to make albums. Mm-hmm. So almost two albums a year for RCA right through the period that he wasn't particularly popular. And some of them have some real artistic treasures buried in them. Then the 80s begins. Lennon's killed and he throws everything into gun control. The contract with RCA is over. He's not making an album a year for them. He makes one album for Mercury, which strangely enough has never been issued in the United States till now. It's only just come out. Flash Harry was originally on Mercury in the UK and Japan. Never came out in the States. Got some great music on it, including this collaboration with Eric Idle. It's the only Nilsson album in which one of the songs is not by Nilsson. It's not sung by Nilsson. It's Eric Idle singing a song about Harry, which is rather sweet. Monty Python Eric Idle singing about Harry making songs. So he doesn't make any more albums. In the 80s, he does a little bit of music for films. He writes a stage musical with Perry Botkin. He does the music for Popeye, the movie. But the career loses its momentum. And then he decides, with Terry Southern, the writer who wrote Magic Christian and various other things, to start a film company. And they make one movie which pays them quite a substantial amount of money. And that's The Telephone, which starred Whoopi Goldberg. Unfortunately, they never followed it up with any other movies, but they carried on spending as if they were making a movie a year. And the business manager that they had running that company simply didn't tell Harry what was going on. So once she'd eaten up the company's money, she started using his money. mm-hmm. as a pop star. And he ended up one morning with a foreclosure notice coming through the doorstep of his house. And he, as he said, he went to bed that night thinking he got $2 million in the bank. And he woke up in the morning and had 40 bucks.
And would have suffer his a kind of massive heart attack, what, about a year or two before the one that eventually killed him at the age of 52. That was in 1994 when he died. Alan, where do you hear his influence, echoes of Harry Nilsson's work in what's around us today?
Well, I think it's influenced a lot of people in quite subliminal ways. So you do find a number of artists. There was a very interesting album made just after his death called For the Love of Harry, in which people right across the spectrum, friends like Jimmy Webb and Randy Newman got together, but also members of various other bands got together. And you realise that from the way that his songs were picked up by groups as different as Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass and Lulu and even Astra Gilberto did a version of Without Her, he was writing songs that were picked up right across the spectrum of popular music from the 70s, and they've never really gone away. I think also the fact that The Point had a subsequent career as a stage show, both sides of the Atlantic. It ran in London with the Monkees, Mickey Dolenz and Davy Jones, both starring in it on the West End stage here in London. And then it was revived again in the 90s in Los Angeles. That's had a big influence too, because almost every children's cartoon musical you see ever owes something to The Point, which was the first specific children's cartoon to be made for telly. And I think the other thing is that the soundtrack to Midnight Cowboy, that evocative sound that we heard with Everybody's Talking, a song which wasn't going to be the title of the film. They tried to commission other people, from Paul Simon and Bob Dylan even wrote a piece for it. Harry wrote a piece himself, which wasn't right. used in the film. But that evocative sound somehow summed up a period. And when John Barry wrote the score for the rest of the film, he based it on that George Tipton arrangement for Harry, because you couldn't really come up with any other musical formula for the rest of that film. And so in the same way that that film summarises an era, Dustin Hoffman, of course, starring in that too, with John Voight. Mm-hmm. Harry's music is the soundtrack to a whole period of the end of the flower power generation, the end of the 60s and on through psychedelia and into the 70s and early 80s. And I think that's the enduring legacy. There's almost no movement that follows that hasn't at some point borrowed a little bit from Harry.
Even indie rocker Amy Mann has recorded a version of Harry Nilsson's song One, which Three Dog Night had that hit single with so many years ago. The book is called Nilsson, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter, a fascinating life and career. Alan Shipton is the author. He's been with us from the studios of the BBC at Oxford. And Alan, nice to have you with us back on Soundcheck today. Thanks so much.
John, it's been a pleasure.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one. No is the saddest experience you'll ever know.
That's Amy Mann and her version of Harry Nilsson's song, One. Coming up in a moment, some live performances that you didn't hear first time around on Soundcheck. Stay with us. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. You know how sometimes at the end of our in-studio performances I'll say something like, there's another song from our artist on soundcheck.org? Well, sometimes we just can't fit all that great music into one show. So we're going to end tonight's program with a couple of those web extras. Mutual Benefit is first. They're a project of the singer-songwriter Jordan Lee, who joined us back in January with his band. The album Love's Crushing Diamond drew high praise from Pitchfork and other taste-making sites. We're a fan of it, too. Here's a song from that session called Auburn Epitaphs. It's Mutual Benefit, recorded live on Soundcheck.
One, two, three, four. Cold wind
starts to change the leaves, and I could see you in my dreams. You carved some words into a stone after you left for the great unknown. You really hoped that it means something. They permeate a part of me. I pause to feel the gravity, and you carve some words into a stone after you left for the great unknown. You really hoped that it means something. That it means something.
Mutual Benefit, Brooklyn band. They were here in our studio in January playing live on Soundcheck, and that song, Auburn Epitaphs, was the one that didn't make it onto the broadcast. Steve Earle joined us earlier this month on the eve of his residency at City Winery. For the first time in his long career, Steve is doing a weekly all-request show on Wednesday nights. You can hear the full session to listen to the rules and what his response might be if you call for Freebird. Here's a song from that session that we're airing for the first time. It's the title track from his album, The Low Highway. Steve Earle in the Soundcheck studio.
Traveling now on the low highway, 3,000 miles to the Frisco Bay, across the rivers wild and a lonesome plains, up a coast and down and back again. I saw empty houses on dead-end streets, people lining up for something to eat. Coast of America watching me through the broken windows in the factories. Naked bones of a better day as I rode down the low highway. Traveling on a low highway by the yellow moon and a light day. Snow white crown on a mountain top, valley down where the shadows fall. Met a man with a rifle in his hand. Been away to battle in a distant land. Taught him to hate and taught him to kill. Now he's out on the road with a hope to build. Nobody knows the price he paid. So he's taking his toll on the low highway. Thank you. traveling up on the low highway. Windows down, listening. Wheels turning round on the asphalt scene. Every sound is a prophecy. I heard an old man grumble and a young girl cry. Brick wall crumble and the white dove flies. Call for justice and a cry for peace. The voice of reason and a roar of a beast. Every mile was a prayer I prayed as I rode down the low highway.
Steve Earle with the title track from his last record, The Low Highway. Recorded live in our studio earlier this month. You can hear the full session at soundcheck.org and like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Soundcheck for updates on live webcasts and exclusive in-studio performances. Tomorrow on the show, Philip Meyer is the author of The Sun, a sprawling novel that chronicles 200 years of a family's history in the oil fields of Texas. He'll join us with a pick three of favorite songs. Plus, it's another installment of That Was a Hit, our series about improbable chart success. And tomorrow we take on a biggie. Yes, friends, I am talking about Kung Fu Fighting. Tomorrow on Soundcheck. The program is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, Mike Katziff, with Amy Pearl. Our theme song is by Marco Benevento. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.